This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Stephen Jenkinson. He's author of the book Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. He will be in Albuquerque and Santa Fe on the weekend of March 18th, and we will give more information about that at the end of the program. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, ma'am.
So this is a very interesting book. It seems that you've devoted your life to being with dying people, with their families, to understanding death, helping people go through the process, looking at it with very clear eyes. How did you come to this line of work?
Well, first of all, it's nice of you to say that I've devoted my whole life to it, but that wouldn't be true. I didn't even come to this probably until my mid-40s or so, and I'd recommend anybody listening not to come to the death trade before then because, boy, you need a lot of gravity in the tank or in the hold of your ship to keep you, upright in the tempest.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know there was a death trade, to be honest. That's what I call it. I know it's not the most user-friendly sound, but it's the most authentic way of referring to it. But I was more or less gently encouraged by somebody over a two-year period to join the hospital staff, and I knew that this was not going to be good for anybody involved, given that I'm not organizational material. But I submitted just on the basis of working with seven or eight or so guys who'd recently had someone die on them, and they were really unhinged, but more compelling for the hospital. They were unnerving the mostly female staff of the hospital because, as the ladies put it, they seemed to divide up into two groups. One of them was belligerent, hostile, aggressive, and the rest. And I said, the other ones, oh, much worse, they said. And I'm thinking, how much worse could that be? And the lady said, they don't say anything at all. And somewhere in there, we were trying to figure out what we were doing in meeting, aside from relieving the hospital folks. And they realized that that as good as they were at being angry, and I want to say that there's legitimacy in anger. You know, it's way too often banished from, especially from the grief business and from the death trade generally, that is if anger has no place. But, you know, I beg to differ. But for all of that, it was a bit of a cover story for them that their anger really clothed the fact that they were not that good where sadness was concerned, and they ended up calling our meeting Sad School, and it went on for something in the order of 18 months, and that's how I found my way in.
And so the book is really fascinating because it's funny that you just said I'm not organizational material. I can sort of imagine, and one can see little glimpses of the kinds of conversations you have with people who are working in the medical system. And as you say, there are a lot of deaths that happen in a medical system that is supposed to make people more comfortable, that is supposed to heal them, that is supposed to be kind. And horrifying things happen there in contexts full of professional, intelligent, well-intentioned people. What's going on? How do you understand this?
Well, at a number of levels, it happens something like this, that the medical system, as I knew it and failed to prosper in it, was one of those things that operated in spite of dying and dying people, not because of them. So you could say, at least the system that I know is very much not a healthcare system, it's a disease management system. When you're in the management business, of course you're going to use the language of failure to describe a dying person's health, which is exactly the way it's referred to, because it's failing to be managed, as if dying is not a legitimate outcome of a person's, you know, life and plans and the rest. The short version to answer your question would be that dying is somehow challenges so deeply what passes for compassion and all the rest in a healthcare system that you could say that whatever compassion survives in healthcare resists realities of dying, and that's deemed to be the most compassionate orientation. So to give you a sense of how insane that is, you could compare it to what kind of care is delivered upon people who've just had a child. In that circumstance, your life is expected to be fundamentally altered by the presence of this child. And when it comes to dying, your life is supposed to be fundamentally not altered by the diagnosis, so that steady as she goes and as normal a life as possible under the circumstances is the reward system in there. And the extent to which you're not able to sustain a normal life is the extent to which the healthcare system visits itself upon you. That's the arrangement. And my alternative has been for years is to plead for the idea that dying, in fact, should be able and allowed, because it's powerful enough, to change everything, including our understanding of what compassion is and love is and what deeply wrought care is. And alas, in the disease management system, that allocation is virtually never given, and I rarely, if ever, saw the healthcare that I was responsible for ever fundamentally altered by the realities of dying.
It's such an interesting analogy that you make, the analogy between how your life changes when you have a child and how your life changes when you go through the death process. Because, I mean, there's multiple people involved in every case.
Yeah.
That parents change their lives and change the arrangement of their houses and their sleep schedules and their jobs and so on to accommodate the child. What's the analogy in the process of death?
Well, there isn't one, unfortunately. The reason I draw the parallel is because both of these visitations are powerful, really beyond limit. That is, their principal power is to oblige you to alter your understanding of what your life is for, given the fact that these things have appeared. That's their power, and it's not disfiguring power. It's a reconfiguring, if you will. It's the power of the presence of a child is to reorder your understanding of why you're alive. And in a lot of cases, at least temporarily, it does that. And, of course, then we get used to kids being around, and we turn back into the knuckleheads that we were before the kids were born. But at least for a while, we get a feeling that our life has been sort of magically reconfigured, and blessedly so. And when it comes to dying, this is absolutely the invitation. It is as powerful, and, you know, people listening now could say, but come on now. The outcome is fundamentally different, and I would say not as much as you think, because in both cases, the power is to change your life in a way that it will never resemble what it once did, and that's in the order of things, you see. So dying is something to be served in the same way the presence of a child is to be served. It's not something to be fought, you know, and after a long and courageous battle, you have a kind of meager write-up in the paper.
Right. And when you're talking about who is serving whom, I mean, when the child is born, the parents are serving him or her. When somebody is in the process of dying, whose perspective are you doing this? Are you talking about the person who's dying or the people who are serving them?
Yes. Everyone, of course. Because, you know, well, I'll give you an idea of how crazy this can actually sound. The distribution rights for a film that I was in were sold to an American distributor. And the first question the distributor asked me, bearing in mind that the movie is about the work I do with dying people, and the question that I was asked is, who's the target audience for the film? Now, this is a film about dying, so my question is, who is it not for? But it never seems to come out that way. It seems to be the dying now are a very particular, very narrow little demographic, when in actual fact, the dying people are everyone eventually.
So you write about in this book, Die Wise, the distinction between seduction and courtship. And I thought that was such an interesting distinction that you make. What do you mean, and what does it have to do with the dying process?
Well, as you've heard me say pretty much already, the dying is to be served. No, I don't mean that in a slavish sense. I mean that in a courtly sense. I mean, for example, to take the item that you just mentioned to me now, seduction is principally, if you think of it, something beyond the obvious kind of sexual connotation. What you get is the idea that seduction is a way of stealing something from someone, preferably without them knowing that you're doing so. So politics by another name, you could say. Courtship, on the other hand, is the act of rendering unto someone something that is probably deeply needed by them, deeply mandatory, without recourse to asking them what it is that they would need or want. So it involves a high degree of discernment and, you know, paying attention and a kind of devotion of the heart. So there's nothing devoted or heartfelt about seduction, you'd grant. So if you take that idea, apply it to dying, then you could say that the principal seduction that goes on, as I've seen it, is business as usual. Not motif, what's the word I need? The mantra. Business as, you know, as normal a life as possible. That is deeply seductive to people who are addicted to the competence that they've been able to wrangle during the course of their days and, of course, all their possessions and all the rest. And the courtship understanding would be something in the order of, rather than coming to your dying as something that's doing something to you, you might well be advised to come to your dying as something that asks something of you. And the response that, that a deeply wrought human can give is not only what is it you ask of me, but how might I best understand why this has come to me now and what my life should look like as a consequence, particularly in the eyes of others, which is where the real meaning of your dying occurs and lasts. And that's what's at stake, is you're teaching people about dying by how you die, and particularly the people who are close to you. Imagine then if you die in rancor and sort of sedated misery and so on, then the teaching that you're offering to people who are not at this dying time in their lives is, whatever you do, don't die like me. Whatever you do, don't die at all. Whatever you do, don't know anything about it, because the less you know about dying, apparently, the less dying you're obliged to do.
This whole question of learning how to die, it's not like learning how to swim or to read or to play an instrument. How do you learn?
Well, I could say by practice, but the practice is the degree to which you attend, either literally or explicitly or just by extension, the death of people before you, you see. A sane culture obviously has as much death as any other culture does. But the one of the marks of a sane culture is that the living are not excluded from the dying. This is not a separate club that you have no right to until you have a terminal diagnosis. In a sane culture, living people attend to dying people, and there's no narrow gate that gains access or entry. You think of the specialization called palliative care that now predominates, and you realize you really couldn't get a narrower gate than palliative care, because who can get to dying people aside from the paid professionals? And the answer is family and close friends only. The poverty that ensues from that is really bottomless. And that's was my job security the entire time I worked in a death trade, is how remote most people's lives are from the reality that is, frankly, awaiting them. The consequence is that people come to their dying time, generally speaking, as amateurs, as rookies, making all the classic blunders, and I would say all the unnecessary blunders. This is all a consequence of the specialization of dying, separating it out from the continuum of healthcare, and the consequence is, among others, that no one knows what to do, and we leave it to the pros. And the truth of the matter is, most professional people, their training is not in dying. Their training is in generic, you know, healthcare and the generic anatomy issues and so on. And the assumption is that somehow you can take all your learning. I should include all the psychological professionals too, that you can take all your generic learning and just magically apply it to the realities of dying, and that there's nothing specific to dying that you have to learn. That's what I saw over and over again, to the point where most physicians really believe that they're capable of not only all their medical stuff, but all the counseling too, that somehow counseling work with dying people, those generic abilities that anybody who's been around for 20 minutes knows how to do.
Now, you said that so many people, because we don't live in a culture where people attend to death, then when your time comes, you make all the classic blunders. What are those blunders?
The beginner mistakes. The principal ones I've probably already alluded to, they would be the idea that you not only are you capable of proceeding as if life is basically the same plus this nagging little diagnosis, but you're actually obliged to proceed that way. So you have this illusion of capacity and obligation to sustain a normal life when actually your normal life is the first casualty of your terminal diagnosis. And, you know, keeping up appearances and, you know, learning how to talk doctor with the doctor as if that's a real language.
What should one do instead?
Well, I'm not really in the business of should, to be honest. What you hear me doing is testifying to what I saw. But, I mean, I think anybody could do the kind of rough calculus on this thing and imagine how it might be otherwise. And one of the ways is to begin to craft a language in which the realities of dying actually appear instead of forbid. I can tell you that what I saw in the death trade over and over again was that euphemisms enjoy a long and healthy employment in the death trade. As long as that happens, dying people cannot in any way find their way, find anything to them, because they're surrounded by people who are talking to them as if it's a cold or the flu, or as if it's a question of, you know, their state of mind. And these are all ways of losing your way, and we have accomplices galore in that loss.
You write about children who are dying, and I think the words that you used were the calm clarity of children who know that they are dying, and yet sometimes they're not told the truth. And that is really shortchanging the child. What would you counsel people who have a child who's dying? Like, when you talk about inventing a language for that, what do you say? How do you talk about it?
Well, you know, there's a lot of artistry involved in this thing. This is not a matter of clubbing people over the head with the obvious, right? You don't tell someone they're dying and believe that you've achieved an understanding by doing so. It doesn't matter what the age is of the person in question. But as far as kids go, kids are generally not told, kids under somewhere like 7 or 8 years old are generally not told that they're dying for two reasons. One, that the psychological people are fairly sure that the idea of dying is something that children don't have the sophisticated kind of insight about endings or about permanence to bring to bear so that they can understand what this dying actually means. So it unnecessarily troubles them is the principal belief. The other belief is that somehow their childhood cannot somehow survive this news. And so there's conspiracies galore within the families as well, to somehow preserve the childhood and keep the realities from the kid. Now, I can tell you that most kids that I work with, and I don't say that they're spiritual geniuses in this matter at all, but one of the things they do have that we eventually unlearn by the time we hit puberty is kids have no understanding, they have no capacity to live anything other than a full life, which is the very that most adults are embroiled in trying to preserve for the child the idea of a potential life. But kids don't have an understanding that their life is a potential anything that requires a future to occur in. So they don't feel ripped off, you see. They obviously understand the misery that's around them and the suffering of their parents and all the rest. But they don't personally feel that their capacity to have a full life is being taken from them. This seems to be particularly an adult thing. So one of the things we could learn from them or from this encounter is to grant the fact that they've lived a full 7-year-old life and they don't have to make it to 9 or to puberty or to bear children in order to for them themselves to know themselves as having lived fully. So there's no ripoff up to a certain age. There's no crime against nature, you see. That seems to come in a little bit later once we became persuaded with the idea that we need a future for our life to be worth anything.
Right, right. There's an amazing story in your book about a family who had a dying son, and he knew he was dying, and then he asked them several questions, including, are there angels?
Yeah.
Will he still be their son after he's dead?
Right.
Will he ever see them again in any way?
Right.
And these are amazing questions, and I was trying to think of, what would I say under those circumstances? I mean, the honest answer is I have no idea. Mm-hmm. But that's probably not satisfying to the child. What would you say if you were asked that?
It's probably not true that you have no idea either. You probably have at least a handful of ideas at any one time about it. You're not certain if any of them, you know, are going to come to pass. But ideas galore, they proliferate in this business. One of the things I said to the parents in that particular case was they were living their lives as if when you die, that's it. And now their child is asking them, if the child's ever going to see them again. And the meat hook that they were on is how to maintain their kind of belief system, whatever that was, and still answer the child's question. So one of the things I offered them, and it's fierce medicine to say something like this. But if you believe that when you die, that's it, now your kid's dying, they ask you if they're going to be your kid after they die, and you want to give some blanket assurance that they will, one of the things you're going to pay attention to after they die is the language that you use, particularly if you begin to refer to your child in the past tense, which, of course, the mental health professionals will oblige you to do eventually. And if you're not able to do that, then people become very concerned about, quote, your adjustment process, right? Because you're supposed to understand that dead people are gone, or the favorite term that seems to proliferate in dominant culture of North America, that they're lost. That's the principal adjective. I lost my father last month. And when you think about the deep meaning of the word lost, you realize that's not a synonym for dying at all, because it doesn't even describe what the dying person did. It describes what you did to them after they died. You, the one who lost them. And if you think it's just a phrase or it's just a word, wonder why it is the most commonly used euphemism to make sure that you don't have to say died. And then you realize, man, all of these things are, they're in the culture, you see, and they're current. This stuff is not antique, and it's not only for people, you know, with not a lot of higher education. Everybody virtually uses this kind of language. So one of the deep questions to wonder about is, what is your lived understanding of all the people who died before you, who granted you your life in the form of your DNA, and your habits, and your culture, and all of that? Are they all gone without a trace, and you're standing here in the presence of virtually nothing? I can tell you that the dying people that I worked with were the heaviest per capita users, if you can call it using, of sedation. And I've just given you a feel for why there's so much sedation used at the end of people's lives in North America, and it has nothing to do with pain or symptoms. It has to do with a lived life that did not in any way anticipate ending. And the consequence is, when people wonder, to say it in a biblical way, unto whom shall I die? The answer that they often have to offer is silence. There's no answer to that question. And it's not a failure of the imagination. It's if you have not lived your life in the presence of a real ancestry, then be not surprised that when your dying time comes, it's like you and the void.
I was just thinking about you, what you were saying a minute ago about talking in present and past tense. My father died when I was a teenager, and one of my peers, wrote to me and said something like, I'm so sorry, I know you love him very much. And it was in the present tense. It wasn't you loved him, but that you love him. And that was the most comforting letter that I got, because he was the only person who realized that he was still alive for me in some way.
Well remembered on your part. I'm not sure that calling him still alive would be the best way to give full voice to what you're saying there. I mean, he's fully dead, certainly. And the question is whether fully dead is the same thing as gone, you see. That's what I mean. And do people who are dead, is their only presence the presence that we grant them by virtue of our willingness to remember them? Is that the only reality? that survives dying. You see, I don't know if it's true where you come from, but where I come from, where I worked, there's no shared understanding of these things at all, to the point where everybody's on their own to basically to fantasize about it. How is one to live when you're on the hook for inventing all the deep realities of life, and they're not testified to, or they're not taught in the world around you while you're growing up? It's no surprise that we come to our dying, I said earlier, as an amateur, maybe we could say so untested that we have no clue what's asked of us.
It's funny, though, because there are people who have a very strong faith. When my father died, we had a friend who was a very strong and devout Catholic, and she very blithely said to me, "It's okay, he's in a better place," and I wanted to punch her. Yeah. And then when her own husband died, she was a complete wreck, and she could not apply that to herself.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, this dilemma you've just described, that I'm, by the way, I understand the punching instinct very much. This scenario you described is not just the problem of, let's say, people who've lived a faith-based life, to use a generic term. This is a problem for anyone who's cobbled together a, quote, belief system about dying that was never really informed by the realities of dying and that was never crafted in the presence of dying. You realize after a while that most belief systems, at least the ones that I worked with, were there as an insurance policy taken out against the realities of dying. And that's why people can stand there and say to you, they're in a better place, as if they really know this, and as if this is supposed to be that way, and as if it's helpful for us all to traffic in this goofiness that says that everything is solved as a consequence of dying.
In your experience, what cultures, what societies do this right? What does it look like? What would you turn to if you were trying to look for an example of somebody who does it better than we do?
Uh-huh. You know, this is probably one of the top three questions I get asked everywhere I go. I've taught in 10 countries, I think, now, and it remains amongst the top three time after time. So before I answer it, I would point all of our attention to thinking, so why would it be that in cultures that are troubled where dying is concerned, one of the most compelling questions is, who's doing it better than us? Rather than, how did it get this way? What is there about our way of living that crafts this inability in us and calls it a skill and things of that kind? But I'm never asked that kind of stuff, I have to tell you. Well, obviously there are places in the world that do this differently. And in, I would say without question, and this is not a matter of opinion, that it's the way they live their lives. It's not how they die that makes their dying the treasure that it is among them, you see. That means they've lived their whole life in the presence of the dying of other people, of course. But not only that, but their own kind of cultural training is partly in dying, that from a very early age, they understood that dying was a legitimate and meaning-driven aspect of their lives, that their lives were in part given over to learning about. And not only that, but they lived, I just taught for a week in Bali not that long ago, and Bali is a good example of a place that, even though it's being tormented by tourism and the rest, they're a lot of their daily life is informed by the presence of their ancestors in their living compound and the presence of what we could call, say, the unseen or the spirits of the places and so on. And they attend to them every day. And this is not a fantasy. I saw it happen. A place like that is inherently more achieved where dying is concerned because they practice it, not practice in the sense of trying to get it right, practice it in the sense of keeping up their end of what living people do where the dead are concerned. Again, I don't know how it's been as you've lived your life, but I can tell you that the mark of a sane society where dying is concerned is not that everybody's clear and lucid on these matters all the time. Not at all. People fall off the edge, you know, everywhere. And the sanity of a culture is that it's not everybody's crazy at the same time. Whereas the culture that I'm a part of, basically that's the attribute of the culture, is that when it comes to dying, almost everybody's crazy in equal measure at the same time. And I think that's where the question comes from, you know, who's doing it better than us? Because we certainly wouldn't look to each other as any kind of a sign or any kind of reassurance that it can be otherwise. And I'm never asked.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the whole palliative care system that you were talking about a little bit before arose in response to a medical system that didn't accept death at all. When I was in college, I lived for a summer in a house. I rented a room in a house where everybody else was a Harvard medical student. It was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and one of them told me this term that they have called dying a Harvard death. And dying a Harvard death meant all your numbers were perfect, but you were dead. And that spoke, I never forgot it, and it spoke to this kind of like imperative to keep people alive at all costs. And even if they're not alive, their numbers are good, which is kind of insanity in itself. But then you've got palliative care, which in theory is about accepting that we're not going to keep people alive. We're going to let them die in as much comfort as is humanly possible. What's wrong with that? Like, what's your critique of that?
Man, we need a couple of hours, but the gist of it is in the term palliative. The verb to palliate, if you look in a dictionary today, it means just what you said it means. It means comfort giving as opposed to curative measures, typically at the end of a person's life. Here's the dilemma. How do you propose to comfort someone who's dying when the cultural context is death phobia? It's not death lucidity. Where does the comfort come from? Because you know, it's not like we give up on comforting. We double down on comforting in a death phobic culture. And the way we do it is that we cloud or cloak or conceal those realities that would seem to make the ability to live comfortably impossible. And that's actually the old meaning of P-A-L-L, the root Latin word of palliate, means to cloak or to shroud or to conceal. So the dilemma is actually in the word palliative itself, that the only way to achieve this comforting is to keep the realities of dying away from the people who are dying. And there is a conspiracy, frankly, to do exactly that, give you a little taste of what that looks like. Most palliative care physicians I worked with said to me that while my ideas were interesting and all the rest, they weren't really for everyone. That's the first accusation I got. And secondly, that they weren't for people who were in physical distress, that had to be dealt with first. And I said, well, how do you do that? And they would say, well, you know, the first thing I do is I establish a relationship of trust. And if that means I can't talk about dying anytime soon, then that's what it means. So I said, let me understand this then, that the way you establish a relationship of trust as a working physician with people who are dying is to co-conspire with them to keep the realities of the dying away until they're ready to talk about them. And they said, basically, yes, as if this is a relationship of trust. I mean, it makes you just slap your forehead and wonder. Well, the truth of the matter is, it comes from the culture. This is not something that's unique to physicians at all. Our understanding of trust has a lot to do with genuflecting to what the self-imposed limitations of tolerance are for the people we propose to be comforting to. And what I did instead was I challenged this idea of comfort to earn its keep, and it never did. So I don't think we're in the business or should be in the business of comforting people at all, given that comforting usually obliges them to know less and less about what's going on. And I think we should be in the job of deep and radical death education, not death palliation.
I'm thinking of a friend of mine, a wonderful woman. She was in her late 70s. She had been a classical music DJ here at the radio station. And she got pancreatic cancer, and I went to visit her, and she was at home, and she had some kind of pain management thing going on where because I guess it was a pretty painful disease, and the pain was under control, and she was reading books in her beautiful house and accepting visitors, and there was this kind of really loving acceptance of what was going on. And we had a wonderful talk and spent an afternoon together, and it was the last time I saw her. And I thought, this is what palliative, I mean, to me, that's what palliative care looks like. She knew exactly what was happening. And I remember she said, we were talking about food, and she said, oh, I'd like to try that. Oh, but I guess I never will. And then we went on to the next subject. And it was very moving for me. And I left in both a state of grace and a state of grief. And I still think about that. But, like, that's, I don't know, what's wrong with that?
Well, obviously, there's nothing wrong with it. Would that it were the order of the day and not the exception. But the reason you're telling the story is because it's exceptional. There's no doubt of that, and it is exceptional. I should say that the language of acceptance is not one that I accept, frankly. The reason being that people who are dying are, in my view, under no obligation to knuckle under to the fact, the sort of blunt force trauma of the fact of their dying. The best way I can think to say that is, you know, being alive is pretty habit-forming and it's pretty compelling. And when your days, the end of your days is fully in view, your inclination to favor being alive even more than you did is enhanced, and properly so. This is not denial. This is wishing it could continue. And dying people, to my mind, are under no obligation to give up on wishing that it could continue. The challenge is to wish it could continue knowing that it won't. And that's where the grief is to be found, is that you don't have to choose between these things, that your ability to love being alive in a strange way or an unexpected way is enhanced by glimpsing the end of that very thing that you hold so dear, which is, I think, why you so beautifully said, you know, I left in grief and grace, because where you find the one well-practiced, the other one is very close at hand, for the reasons that we've both just said amen to.
You write in your book that a good death is a right, it's a moral obligation, it's a political act, it's an act of love, of spiritual activism, of subversion, and I think probably listening to you talk for this time that we've been talking, people can begin to understand what you're talking about. And I was thinking, I mean, if people were to think about death differently, part of that would be thinking about themselves as part of a generation, as part of a cycle of life. And have you found that when people's attitudes toward death shift, they also get different attitudes toward aging here in our extremely youth-centered society where we're all supposed to be 29 for life?
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is a good observation. You know, we could say something to begin answering that by acknowledging a kind of sad truth, which is there are proliferation of palliative care services and hospice services across North America these days, many more than there were even 5 years ago. But I would submit to you this is no more an indication of our deep willingness to learn dying and to serve it well than is the proliferation of old folks' homes across that same dominant culture of North America, a sign that we venerate age and that we ourselves are looking forward to joining that august company. The tragic irony is the more we specialize, the less most of us know about it. There's the first dilemma. Dying is not that difficult. What makes it so deeply undoing is that it's happening in a culture that, frankly, just doesn't believe in it, you see. So one of the things I'm on about is that dying is a, if I could use a strange language, dying is a god. And in many cultures, that's exactly what dying is a god to be learned and to be served. Again, not in a slavish sense, but in the deeply informed human sense. You know, your dying is not the end of your humanity. However, when dying has become such a med tech event, then it's no surprise that dying comes to be understood as what happens to you instead of something that you do. But even the grammar of dying, the literal word, is not a word that we can use in the passive voice in the English language. You can't use the verb to die in the passive voice. Even grammatically, our language is whispering to us that dying is not something you're on the receiving end of. It's something you're on the crafting end of. It's what you do. It's active. Cancer is what happens to you, yes. But dying is what you do while cancer is doing what it does. And it's not a given what you will do in the presence of that. And your dying is what your family and friends will have. It's probably the most precious thing that you can hand over to them. If you're dying, for example, as a mother or father, sister or brother, then your dying is not the annihilation of your parenting or your family presence. Your dying is how you mother or father someone. So that list of things you read from Die Wise there, the list of what dying must be. If you die wise, this is a moral act, meaning you're proceeding as if you have an understanding of your deep responsibility to the people around you, which is not extinguished by a terminal diagnosis, even though most dying people that I worked with had long ago been absolved of any deep responsibility to other people, as if our understanding is that dying so hard that the first thing we should do is make sure that you're not bound by the language of the living to the world or to anyone else other than your own dying and the way in which you can be, let's say, indulged while you are.
The thing that I thought of so much while reading your book was the question of time, and there's a lot of different ways to think about time, and you write about time and, you know, death as being an opportunity to think differently about time. But what I was really thinking about was when somebody's dying, you don't get time off from work. When somebody's dead, you might get 2 days or 5 days of bereavement leave, but all of that time is stuck inside a very kind of Cartesian grid of corporate culture and doesn't have that organic quality of how much time does this actually take and how much time do we actually need?
Well, very well observed. In my country, Canada, we have maternity leave, which is upwards of a year, and there's a kind of financial reward system in place for that, properly so. Paternity leave is less commonly sought, and it's not a year, but it's something. And when someone dies, there's 3 paid days off of work. The idea being, of course, that apparently the presence of someone in your life suddenly requires a year of real time off from, so that you can learn how to have this person in your life. But when it comes to having someone no longer in your life in a present way, apparently you can learn how to do this in 3 days and then be back on the job on Monday.
Yeah, and the fact that we don't make time for it, I think, is what it's sort of like our not being able to make time for it as society gets in the way of somebody else's productivity schedule or something like that. And, you know, that's the way we're set up. And I'm sure it's framed for a lot of people as one of the prices we pay for living in a complex industrial society. But not only do we not have time for those who are dying, but we don't have time for our own grief. And I was thinking, I mean, if people were to really take to heart and start working with your ideas or the ideas of treating death in a very different way, it could have a very profound social impact because the nature of conversation could change and shift as people were actually honest about their grieving process, for example.
Well, you know, thank you for crediting me with the possibility that I could have a cultural implication to what I'm trying to do, because that's exactly where I'm aiming. That's true. I crafted a phrase that I was trying to find a way of making sense of the remarkable devotion that people make to their normal life, however that's constituted in people's everyday existence. But there's a kind of religion called normal life, And I realized that, in North America, the principal addiction is to competence. And so I came to use this phrase, competence addiction, as something that really proliferates around dying time. Among dying people, yes, but also among people who are the family and friends of somebody who's dying. And we all seem to be more than willing to hold each other to the idea that grief is an understandable intrusion into your normal life, and that the best grief is the one that's contained in consequence, and it's also contained in duration. So hence your understanding of time there. The idea being that the best grief is the one that messes with your normal life the least. It's really damage control, and that's what psychology has done to an understanding of grief, is that it's a kind of a time-limited proposition. What dying and grief in particular do is they so overwhelm your understanding of what's normal and what's necessary, and they also overwhelm your feeling of time passing to the point where it seems to happen in clumps. Time is very intense for a while and then becomes invisible and seems to not pass at all. And, you know, everything in between. The truth of the matter is, that's what time really does. Time has nothing to do with clocks and productivity. Time has to do with, you could say, it's a meaning-driven and meaning-centered event for us. That's what time really is. And the idea that time heals all is absolute lunacy. But let's go further and say, there are some things that are not supposed to be healed if by healing we mean to get on with your life, as if there's a life to get back to after someone close to you dies, that somehow survives all of this, more or less uninformed and untouched. If anything, this is a recipe for the disappearance of dying people, that our mania for being okay guarantees that the dying disappear from our midst.
It's just about time to go, but I have to ask you this. It's become common to hear people say, and I think I've said it, that it's too bad we can't die as peacefully and humanely as our dogs.
Yeah.
What, if anything, do you think that we can learn about human death from the death of our animals and the way we treat animals?
Oh, man. Well, now you're asking a farmer this question. This is what I do much of the time, is farming, and there's a lot of death that happens on the farm. Most of it is calculated. Most dying on the farm, when you have animals, is a consequence of decisions that you make, largely, hopefully, if you're not too debt-burdened and your conscience is still reasonably intact, the calculations are informed by the well-being of the animal. And in the case of domestication, we take upon ourselves a covenant to replace the wolf, if you will. Like I have sheep, for example. So the wolf once kept the sheep healthy. When you keep the wolf from your sheep, you have to assume that responsibility of keeping your sheep healthy. And one of the ways you do it is virtually exactly what the wolf did, is that you take out the weak and the maimed and so forth. This is taking dying and death and killing into your hands in that case, and this upsets a lot of sort of green people. Well, they're upset at consequence of their own naivety on these matters, unfortunately. So the question is, what does dying ask of us? I don't think the question is, what kind of dying do we, quote, deserve? Because when you use the language of deserving, you're back in this thing that even dying is there to serve you, and that, you know, your option for euthanasia is basically a lifestyle choice to be informed by your own belief system. And when you exercise it, you have no obligation to deal with the consequences of having done so, because you're out of here. At that level, there's not much distinction between invoking euthanasia as a right and suicide as a right, because both of them absolve you of learning deeply the implications of your exercising your right in these matters. So we could come to our dying more as something to be learned and served, and learned again and served some more, and not something to be thwarted or contended with or coped with, or when all else fails, to escape from. You know, the deep reality of that is that the people around us, their lives are deepened in seeing the deep human encounter and, yes, sometimes struggle with the realities of dying. But I say again, most of the deep struggle does not come from the nature of dying. Most of it comes from dying in a culture that does not believe in dying. And that's where the line to be found. I wouldn't say that your dogs and cats live in the same kind of world that banishes dying, and they probably don't suffer as a consequence the way we do, we who are dying right beside them.
Stephen Jenkinson is author of the book Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. He will be in New Mexico. He'll be in Albuquerque and Santa Fe the weekend of the 18th of March. For more information on the various events that he's doing here in New Mexico, you can go to orphanwisdom.com. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I appreciate the invitation. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.